Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup today, we move into reopening phase 2.5. It's an earlier than anticipated loosening of restrictions, but bars remain closed. As college students head back to school, campuses experience more COVID clusters, but Duke University appears to be faring better than most. High school graduations were virtual last spring, but the graduation rate was flat, raising questions about resuming testing and accountability standards. The Panthers will play without fans in the stands, contrary to what they hoped for, and owners and operators of area sports venues get ready for to be early voting locations. Here to talk about those stories and much more is Ann Doss Helms, education reporter for WFAE News. Good morning, Ann.
Good morning.
Joe Bruno is back from WSSC-TV Channel 9 Eyewitness News. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Glenn Berkins is here. He's founder and publisher of QCityMetro.com. Hello, hello.
Good morning.
And Eric Spanberg is managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. He's the one laughing at me, of course. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning, Mike. I'll try and behave.
We have not reached the benchmark of a 5% infection rate yet. We are still at 7%, but the numbers have been stable. So Governor Cooper decided to allow a careful step forward and move to something he calls phase 2.5 of coronavirus restrictions as of Friday afternoon. That would be today if you're listening live at 5 p.m.
Moving to phase 2.5 means that we can safely do a few more things while still fighting the virus as vigorously as ever.
So what does this mean? What is now who can now open as of 5 o'clock?
Well, you can. Eric. Gyms, I think, is one of the big ones. Gyms and indoor fitness centers can open at 30%. Bowling alleys, of course, we've had a lot of discussion about bowling alleys and the legal back and forth. Museums and aquariums at 50%. Playgrounds will now be open. So you are seeing, as you said, some loosening. Restaurants, nail and hair salons remain at 50%. And, of course, bars and indoor entertainment, movie theaters remain closed.
Before we get to that, there's another piece of good news in here, I guess, because for the first time since March, Joe, nursing homes, you can go and visit your loved one in a nursing home, but it has to be, what, outdoors? Is that how it has to work?
Yeah, it's not a free-for-all. They're still handling that very carefully, but at least now you have that option.
So the governor cited our stable infection numbers and in some cases decreases in the rate of COVID-19 positive tests and case growth and hospitalizations. But he did say we're not out of the woods yet and that we have to be careful. But when you loosen restrictions like this, does that just send, I don't know, false hope out to people who then become a little more cavalier about following instructions?
Well, that's what you heard quickly from Mandy Cohen, the Health and Human Services Secretary, and others. They were saying, and the governor said this as well, is not an excuse or a reason or an allowance to relax in any way from wearing a mask and social distancing and all those other steps that people have been asked to take. And there was a question asked to the governor of whether this would inevitably lead to a rise in cases and hospitalizations. And he said, not if people continue doing what they are supposed to do. So we're going to see here, obviously, in the next couple of weeks, whether they do.
And I think it's the coincidence that the state today is launching a public relations campaign, encouraging people to continue wearing masks. I think they recognize exactly what you were saying, Mike, but in reality, these are very modest steps in terms of they're not museums 50%, as he said, gyms 30%. I think that one probably has the most potential allowing people back into gyms. But gym owners are saying that that they have protocols in place to protect the public.
You know, the big difference now and the last time that we reopened is we have the mask mandate in effect now. So it'll be a good test to see if the mask really can reduce the spread here.
Yeah.
And there's also been a change in the size of gatherings allowed. I believe indoors has gone from 10 to 25 and outdoors has gone from 25 to 50. So, for instance, the High School Athletic Association is saying this is going to allow us to have slightly bigger gatherings, still not formal practices, not competitions, but these workout and training sessions. They're going to be able to expand on those.
And getting back to something that Glenn said a minute ago, gym owners have been advocating for reopening for months now because they've been saying there's been no reason why they couldn't open. And some, in fact, did open despite the restrictions against it, and then they were closed down. The governor cited new and emerging science showing that the virus doesn't spread as easily on surfaces as originally thought. Melissa Price owns Burn Boot Camp Mallard Creek, and she told Fox 46 Charlotte that while one weight has now been lifted, another is still hanging over her gym.
It is a relief, but I still feel that heavy weight of responsibility to make sure that we're keeping everybody safe.
And as you said, Glenn, gym owners have been saying they've been taking those precautions or were willing to take those precautions if they could open. We'll see what happens. The Queen City Metro reported on YMCA branches. They've been serving as sites, for COVID-19 testing and things like that. Well, now with this new order, they can open their fitness facilities. But they are largely nonprofit. I didn't know this until I read your article about this. They have not benefited from the paycheck protection money coming in. Why not? Glenn.
I'm not sure about that. I'm not sure about that answer.
Okay. We've seen in other parts of the country as things open up that the incidence of virus does, in fact, tend to rise. So how do you keep people safe in this? Just socially distance and wear masks and hope for the best and spray equipment down if you're a gym? Is that the idea here?
Yeah, I think so. I think one of the big keys, obviously, is keeping people at a distance because the aerosols that are breathed and people are breathing heavily because they're exercising, that is probably the number one concern. And that was the reason given for the 30% rather than a 50% capacity as these indoor fitness centers reopen.
Well, and go ahead.
I think for down Charlotte, the really big change is going to be the museums are opening again. The Levine Center for the Arts, the Harvey Gantt Center, the Mint Museum, the Beckler, they're going to be allowed to open again. And many of them are putting safeguards into place right now to allow that to happen. They're not going to open immediately, but over the first few weeks in September, we are going to see them start to reopen.
Yeah, other states have proven they can reopen gyms safely. I think we're one of the last, if not the last state, to actually reopen these fitness facilities. The key is, just spacing out the equipment, making sure it's wiped down after each use, and really wearing those masks as much as possible. There is an exception for strenuous exercise, so if you really cannot wear one, you don't have to. But, if you're just wandering around the gym or talking to people, you should definitely have that face covering on.
Well, 30% capacity is better than 0% capacity, but can the average gym owner make it on 30% capacity? Because you can't accommodate your membership, it seems to me. Or maybe you can. I mean, some of these people buy memberships in January and never come back, so I don't know what the case is there. Eric, do you have any insight into as a business person?
I think it's like so many of these businesses, restaurants and, just stores in general, when you're at 30% or 50%, you can do this for a little while. You can't just do it, without any end in sight. And that's what you're hearing business owners say across the board in these various industries. So does it help? To your point, yes, 30% is better than 0%, but it's not something where you can do this, without any end in sight. They're going to need to move up to full capacity, within 6 months to a year, or else you just don't have the revenue.
So we've been pushing back the start of phase three, which opens the floodgates even more. And we pushed it back for months now, it seems to me. And September 11th was the target date for the new announcement to move either to stay in phase two or to move to phase three. Well, now we're in phase 2.5, and that goes through October the 2nd. So does that take September 11th as a possible phase three reopening date off the table?
Yes. This was a preemptive move, yes.
Okay. Under phase 2.5, movie theaters, nightclubs are still closed, as well as bars, which have been closed since March and will remain closed, even though the bar owners keep pointing to breweries and places like that have been allowed to open. Kevin, is it Galian? Is that how you say his name, Joe?
Galian, correct, yes.
Kevin, he owns the El Centenario nightclub near University City, and he told you and WSOC-TV that he's considering reopening in defiance of the governor's order.
It's coming down to the point where you either take that chance or you let them turn the power off, the water off, and you lose. You fold up like some other people already did.
He told you that his water bill is due, his power bill is due, and he has no money to pay them, none whatsoever. And he applied for various available loans and heard nothing back. How unusual is that? Or is that happening a lot?
That has been the story of many different business owners. Unfortunately for him, you know, it's just gotten to the point where he's ready to shut it all down if he doesn't reopen once again. The only reason he's still here right now is because back in July, he reopened in defiance of the governor's order. He made money for a couple of weeks, and then CMPD came in and cited him, and he shut the business down. But now he's like, I don't know what to do. I won't make it until October 2nd. So he might have to open his doors once again.
As you said, they shut him down back in July. And when you open under restrictions like that and you're a bar, you put your ABC license in jeopardy. And the fact that he's willing to take that chance again, potentially, obviously speaks volumes. Does he not think he can make it till October 2nd?
He knows the risk, but he's just desperate. What else is he going to do? He doesn't have any money right now. He's lost hundreds of thousands of dollars. He doesn't know what to do, honestly.
Wow. Eric, the Charlotte Business Journal published a Business Pulse poll asking people's thoughts about the speed of the reopening policy. Your publication talked to 501 people. Do you know the results? I do.
Give me the results, Mike. Okay. I'm terrible with my own poll, always.
All right. 59% said that we are moving too slow and should be fully open by now. 35% said we're moving at just the right speed. And 6% said we're moving too fast, that we should tighten the restrictions. So it's 501 people. Is this at all scientific?
It's not scientific. But what I would say to you, Mike, is that I'm actually a little surprised that it's only 59%, because, you know, I'm talking to business owners all the time and they're incredibly impatient. And to Joe's story and point, in many cases, it's because they've been 5-6 months, obviously, with no revenue or reduced revenue, and they just feel this incredible financial pressure.
Mike, there is a similar poll that the Census Bureau is taking, called the Pulse poll as well, where they look at, ask business owners similar questions. And surprisingly, I think it was in the 30% range. They ask about the economic impact that this has had on business owners. And I think only 30 some percent said that their businesses had been severely impacted by COVID. I expected that number to be much higher.
Yeah. Joe.
We just talked about how gyms can only open at 30% and they might be at risk because they can't have full capacity. Kevin Galian would kill for 30% right now. He wants to be able to open at reduced capacity, space out tables, get some sort of revenue flowing into his establishment. But right now he can't.
And as part of the 2.5 move, they've extended the 11 p.m. curfew for alcohol sales in restaurants. They still can't do that, but they have allowed, at least in the Mecklenburg County and the surrounding unincorporated areas, to serve food past 11 p.m. now. That's not a risk?
People aren't packing clubs to get food at late hours. They are for alcohol.
Okay, we have to take a break. We will regroup and come back with more in just a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Fifth Third Bank, dedicated to the financial empowerment of the community by investing time, resources, and people in the Charlotte area and throughout the state. More at 53.com. It's Charlotte Talks and the Local News Roundup on 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. Mike Collins here with Ann Doss Helms from WFAE News, Joe Bruno from WSOC-TV, Glenn Birkins from QCityMetro.com, and Eric Spanberg from The Business Journal. Mecklenburg County Health Director Gibby Harris has said the continuing restrictions on alcohol sales are an effective way to limit large numbers of mostly younger residents from gathering with limited social distancing and face masks. And that is where the increase in cases is coming from, among younger people who are not social distancing and not wearing face masks. And it's something that North Carolina colleges and universities have rather quickly discovered as classes resumed. And how many college students in the state have tested positive in just the last few weeks? Do you know?
More than 3,000. And that's it's mainly at three universities, UNC Chapel Hill, NC State, and ECU. They all opened August 10th. And young people gathered, yeah, presumably to drink alcohol in some cases. And they were not probably observing all the social distancing. And so in many cases, they have backed away from in-person classes. So, yeah, there are some real concerns that it's difficult to get people to follow the rules that you lay down.
So we know that UNC Chapel Hill reversed course. They opened for about a week. Students moved in. Then they had to close. Students moved out. NC State, ECU halted undergraduate in-person classes too and moved students out of the dorms. But UNC Greensboro has not experienced this. They've been back since August 18th. Davidson is offering on-campus instruction and online learning as well. They haven't seen these COVID clusters. Cases at Duke University evidently are low to non-existent. How do health officials explain that? What are they doing differently?
I don't know. And I think that's a huge question. I don't know how much is a question of size. I don't know if there are different cultures, if there are different testing. In other words, you know, is one university doing better at catching the asymptomatic? Because it is my understanding that a lot of these are not kids who are going back and falling desperately ill, but who are getting a positive test, even though they may not feel sick, which makes this even more complicated.
And there are, Mike, a lot of differences in terms of how colleges report and what they report. So there are vagaries there as well.
Well, I was going to get to that because, Anne, you said
sorry.
That's okay. Adding to the uncertainty of what is happening and what might happen, there is apparently a tremendous disparity in transparency and how colleges and universities are reporting these cases. Is that because they're holding information back or because there's no standard for reporting this information?
I'm not sure that there's a standard, and I think we're seeing this with colleges and with K-12. With K-12, there are clusters that have to be reported, but you're seeing some districts will send out a press release, you know, announcing their week-by-week tallies. Other districts, Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools, I'm talking about you, don't say much at all until they are specifically asked about something that people have heard about. So I get that all of these health and education bureaucracies have their hands very, very full with dealing with the coronavirus, but it seems like clear, consistent, transparent reporting on what is and is not happening would be really helpful to everyone. You know, and I think in schools you're seeing some individual cases that then don't spread into a cluster. And that's actually helpful to know. That's kind of a good thing.
That's an excellent question, Mike. I would be remiss if I didn't point out that in South Carolina, my alma mater, University of South Carolina, made national headlines with, I think, 1,000 cases, active cases. We can't win at football, but we're number one.
Take that, Clemson.
That's right. So we had some technology glitches in public education throughout the state in the first week, and I think the first day of the second week of school. Has all of that been ironed out? Are things relatively are classes, online classes, relatively smooth at the moment, Anne?
Well, I have not heard of any massive statewide or national crashes. I don't think that means that every family is having a smooth experience, but it does seem to be getting on track. What we seem to have had were when things opened up and all of a sudden, thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, we kind of had one round when North Carolina schools opened, and then we had a national situation a week or two later when a lot of other huge districts around the country all started using Zoom. So I think it's getting better.
You reported this week on the outcome from last semester when schools were forced to close early because of COVID, and that left administrators scrambling to try to figure out how to graduate and how to grade, in fact, because there were no end-of-year tests. And you say that the upheaval didn't have much of an effect. How so?
Well, the state reported a statewide graduation rate of 87.6% of seniors graduating in 4 years. That's up about a percentage point. And in some ways, that didn't surprise me. They made it very difficult. They didn't want anybody to be penalized because they were sent home in their last quarter of their senior year. So things like there was a CPR requirement, and all of a sudden you couldn't go take an in-person CPR class. So they got rid of that. They pretty much said, if you've got a passing grade as of the end of the third quarter, you're going to get credit for that class. So wouldn't have expected a major negative or positive impact. And in fact, that's what we saw. You know, whether it was by school or by district, some went up a little, some went down a little. That's generally what you see year to year. Over the long haul trend, there have been pretty steady increases in graduation rates in North Carolina and in most of its districts. Right. So that's a good thing.
You reported that CMS held flat in their graduation rate. Kind of Union County did too, although they were higher than CMS, but they too were flat. And Gaston County was up about, 3% from where they were the previous year. Graduation rates among white and Asian students were higher than those of blacks and Hispanics, but that's not new. So again, does that mean that this pandemic had no effect, or how they handled the pandemic had no effect?
I think it's safe to say it had no effect on graduation rates for 2020. Okay. What we don't know is the long term. And to me, one of the most striking things about this week is what we didn't have. We didn't have these massive data dumps of test scores where you look at how third graders did on reading and how eighth graders did on math and, you know, all of these comparisons in which the schools with high concentrations of poverty and Black and Hispanic students trail way below the more affluent and white and Asian schools. We didn't have the school letter grades, the list of low-performing schools. And I'm not sure that's totally a bad thing. It potentially allows the state to do a reset and say, we want accountability, we want data, are we getting what we want, and is it getting us where we want, which is not just to every year go, wow, this is horrible, but to say, how do we fix it? And the sort of, wow, this is horrible moment for me and just the graduation rates was seeing that for Charlotte Mecklenburg schools, the largest increase in the number of graduates is among students who are classified as Hispanic and or English learners. Again, no surprise, we've been seeing enrollment do that. But they are not just below their white counterparts, but they are below state averages for those same groups. So that's a challenge.
Yesterday on this program, we spent an hour talking about the digital divide in which 16,000 students just within CMS are having trouble accessing the internet. And the system is trying to alleviate those problems using various different means. But some kids are having the opposite problem. They're having a too much screen time problem. And are parents complaining about this? Their kids are spending too much time in front of a computer screen?
Oh, yeah. Go on any form of social media where parents and teachers are interacting. Bring that topic up and you will get an earful. There is a real concern that for any age group that you're just sitting in front of a screen for too much of the day, but especially for the younger kids. You know, there's sort of this mythology that, you know, 2-year-olds are better at computers than we all are. But that's not totally true when you're using platforms like Zoom and Canvas and things where you have to, you know, we have learned how to navigate, how to troubleshoot. We can do a Google search to try to figure out how to solve our problems. These little kids are trying to figure out, and right, they're not fully able to read yet, in some cases not able to read at all, which means, again, and this goes back to that divide, if you have an adult sitting right at your side to coach you through all of this, you may be able to get through the day, even though you may be very frustrated, and your parents are going to be really frustrated. If you don't have that, you're probably not getting much out of it at all.
Concerns about screen time have been around since the 50s when television became a part of our lives, and parents were encouraged to get their kids away from the TV because sitting in front of it was not good for them. And the American Academy of Pediatrics has recommended that school-aged children be limited to 2 hours of screen time per day. Of course, that's not possible if you're taking education on screen and you're doing homework on screen. But what I read yesterday, and I think it may have been one of your reports, that there's a bright side to this, and that is that kids who spend all day in front of the computer because of classwork and homework are less likely to want to go back to that computer and play games at night. Is that true?
Well, that was not like a scientific report, but that was a high school student that I talked to. And I should note that the 2-hour limit actually was lifted several years ago.
Okay.
As the pediatricians realized that screen time is not necessarily just sitting there staring at something. And you and I are old enough to remember when Sesame Street was considered to be a big hazard for young kids because they would just sit and stare at the TV screen. But they were saying things like Skyping with relatives can be good. There may be some interactive learning that's good. So, and that's what I was hearing from parents, that in some cases, the classroom time, they call it synchronous learning, where a teacher is interacting on Zoom with her students, sort of like we are now. The kids are actually kind of okay with that because they're seeing their friends and they're seeing their teacher. And if the teachers are good at it, they've got the kids, you know, go get your blocks, you know, hold up this number of blocks, do this. And it's that asynchronous learning that had been, and that is the do it on your own, that it, people are saying is not really working all that well, that it was really well-intentioned. CMS created all these, what they call shells, you know, pre-produced lessons that saves the teacher some planning time. But I'm hearing from a lot of parents and teachers that they're really not very engaging.
So live is always better than tape, than DVR.
I've always said that.
Okay. Students are also having trouble evidently multitasking in this environment. You think that none of us really can multitask. That's a fact. But students also in this online environment have to open a lot of different tabs on their computer and go back and forth. I don't know how that's different from opening different books on your desk and looking as you're doing research and writing a paper, but evidently it is different. And young people are having a problem with that, like Alex Rambo Navarrete, who is a Myers Park High School senior.
During the English class, I got a notification on my computer saying physics assignment due today. I said, oh, okay, well, I need to do that before the school day ends. So I cranked that out and I realized that I missed 10 or 15 minutes of English class because I got distracted by that.
So is this just a learning curve that has to be mounted? Is there a solution to something like that?
Well, I don't, you know, and it is always a challenge. In a regular physical classroom, you would have teachers saying, Alex, put away your phone. You know, she saw him pulling it up and, you know, being distracted. As many of us know who have been in a lot of Zoom meetings, it is possible to be looking at the screen and looking like you're paying attention when, in fact, you have your email up or you have something else up doing another task. And it was interesting because his mother, Gina Navarrete, who is a neuropsychologist, said there are a lot of studies that say we all think we're great at multitasking and we're not good at it at all.
Yeah.
And she thought he was gaming and he says, no, I'm not gaming, but I'm doing a lot of different things. Sometimes it's school related, sometimes not so much.
So all the things we've talked about in the last 5 minutes are reasons that CMS wants to go back and why the parents want the kids to go back and why the kids want to go back to school. And actually CMS is now working on a phased in plan to return children to the classroom. What do you know about that plan?
Well, it's sort of been getting out in dribs and drabs. The superintendent told employees probably a couple of weeks ago, this is what they were trying to do and that they wanted to start with not just bring everybody back and plan B, you know, Shazam at one moment, but start with the youngest kids because again, that's where the frustration is that this is really the online is not working for them. And kids with special needs who again, may not be able to engage in the online learning in the way that other students might be able to. I think that we're going to maybe get an update on this in Tuesday's board meeting, although it's not on their agenda yet. Their communication on this has not been really super good.
What a surprise.
But yeah. Well, and in fact, their press person abruptly retired as of immediately last week. So there's changes going on there. But there are a lot of questions still about how this would work. Let's say they bring back the pre-K through grade 2 students, which is one of the ideas that's out there. You can have an elementary school where half the classrooms aren't in use, so you could spread out the kids, maybe have everybody there all day, every day, except then what happens when you bring back the 3rd, 4th, and 5th graders? And the same is being discussed potentially. You bring back the 6th graders and the 9th graders to high school. So again, I'm hoping we will get more details about this. And simultaneously, they've got this panel that's looking at the metrics to figure out when it's appropriate to do this. You know, the phase in is sort of the how, and the open question is the when is it safe to do this? They had one private meeting, then they had one public meeting, then they announced a tentative meeting for this week and then canceled it. So we don't know when the metrics panel is coming back.
So I read that they're thinking about starting this in mid-September. If they meet and talk about this next Tuesday, that would be September the 8th. The following Tuesday is September the 15th. That is mid-September. So I guess if they're going to do this by mid-September, we'll know something, one hopes, by next week. The state legislature also was in session quickly yesterday. And Eric, they approved coronavirus relief unanimously. What does that entail?
There's about, I think, $900 million left in federal recovery money that the state is trying to figure out how to spend. The legislature has largely done that. Of course, the governor will have a little bit of say anyway on this. He offered a kind of a mixed response. He was critical of, the lack of expansion of Medicaid. But it does, the bill that the legislature passed does things like it provides $300 check, $335 to parents to help make up some of the costs of homeschool learning. It provides bonuses to education workers and teachers. So those are some of the things that the money will be spent on.
And on Monday, the Carolina Panthers announced that the state had denied their request to have reduced capacity attendance for their first season opening home game on September the 13th at Bank of America Stadium. That means no fans in the stands. How many people were they hoping, Eric, to have in those stands? Seats what, 67,000 people?
75,000 people. 75,000. And I will give credit to Joe Bruno, who is, I think, with us, who dug up the 12,500 request in terms of capacity. Most NFL teams have looked at 20 to 25%, which would be between roughly 15 and 20,000. And David Tepper was very frustrated when he spoke to the media about this, and they're hoping that they can get permission maybe for the second home game on October 4th to have something.
Exactly. But David Tepper, the owner, appears to be understanding about this.
Listen, I understand Cooper has a difficult job with this COVID from, you know, an optics standpoint and a science standpoint.
Now, Joe, under these new regulations, if you're outdoors, 50 people can gather. I know that's a lot less than 12,500. And we'll talk about the mechanics of that in a second. But very quickly, aren't there more than 50 people on a football field when the teams are playing?
There are, but those are considered essential employees. So those are not, they are exempt from the mass gathering ordinance.
Okay. We'll come back and talk some more about this and what this all means for the season going forward and what the impact of the virus may be on a lot of other Panther plans as well when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. I'm Mike Collins. Coming up next Wednesday on Charlotte Talks, Mayor Vi Lyles will join me for another edition of Mike and the Mayor, and we'd like to hear from you. We want your questions and comments for Mayor Lyles. All you have to do is email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org to submit your questions for next Wednesday's edition of Charlotte Talks. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Ann Doss Helms is here from WFAE News. Glenn Birkins, founder and publisher of QCityMetro.com. Eric Spanberg, managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. And Joe Bruno from WSSC-TV Channel 9. David Tepper, owner of the Panthers, said the team involved scientists in formulating their plan to bring at least 12,500 people back into the stands. They brought in an infectious disease expert or experts. They ran computer simulations so they could come up with the safest plan. This is more than the federal government is doing, my gosh. Only to see this plan rejected by the state. Why is 20 to 25% capacity in an outdoor stadium that fits 75,000 people, why can't they make that work? Joe.
Well, first, Mike, you have to remember that Tepper has more money than the federal government. Go ahead, Joe.
I asked Dr. Mandy Cohen, why can't the Panthers bring back a small amount of fans, 12,500? You know, we got a stadium full of 70 that can hold 75,000. And her answer was, you know, it's really in line with what other places are doing. There's no fans with the MLB, no fans for the NHL. Most NFL teams are not having fans for this first game in September. So she said people really shouldn't be surprised at this. Tepper, to his credit, had a great plan in place. You know, 12,500, he was talking about having seating pods. So like 1 to 5 people would all sit in the same area and then they would space out rows. There'd be no people in the same like back-to-back rows. people wouldn't sit across the aisle from each other. There would be staggered arrival times. So like people would have a designated time that they were to actually enter into the stadium. So, you know, every 30 minutes, they would shuffle in about 3,000 fans. They were talking about mandatory spacing on escalators, shutting down the elevators, except for people with disabilities. They even purchased these disinfecting robots, which are they go around in the rooms and they spray the rooms after people are done and spray the wheelchairs and other shared touch equipment. So Tepper, to his credit, has a very detailed plan, but ultimately the state did not accept it at this time.
Do the robots say "Danger, Will Robinson"? Is that
major throwback.
That's right. There are three NFL teams that intend to have people in the stands. Where are they? Do you know who they are and how they're getting away with this?
The Dolphins are having about 13,000. The Jaguars are having about 14,000. The Chiefs are making plans to have about 16,000. Where we're seeing more teams bringing back fans are in the college level. A lot of the SEC and other Southern schools are making plans to return.
And speaking of the college, the stadium is scheduled to host a college game on September the 26th, Notre Dame versus Wake Forest. Is that also going to be without fans because of our state regulations?
Well, that's now without fans, and that has been moved to Winston-Salem to Wake Forest Stadium because obviously the size of the venue no longer matters as much.
You always hear that all the money in football comes from the TV rights and the TV broadcast, but Tepper has said the red ink is going to flow. So what is the financial impact of not having anybody in the stands? Because I know that 70% of fans were allowed to opt out of not purchasing season tickets this year. What's the financial impact of that?
Yeah, well, 100% were offered option to opt out. 70% took them up on that, and it's probably gone up since the news this week. No one has said specifically, but in rough numbers, Mike, the Panthers, according to Forbes, generated right around $80 million in ticket revenue in 2018, the most recent numbers, out of about $420 million in revenue. So it is significant. And then remember, when you don't have fans, you're also not selling popcorn and beer and Cokes, and you're not generating the other revenue that comes with having people in the building. And finally, with sponsors, you're going to have to make adjustments because they're not reaching as many people, obviously, inside the stadium as they expected to. So there are a lot of financial ripple effects with this.
And of course, parking. No one's paying for parking either, Joe.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, the thing about Tepper is he just has a ton of money, and he makes his money from other places other than the Panthers. So he doesn't need the Panthers to really make money. What he has stressed is that he is the most disappointed that he just can't offer fans anything right now. The reason he does this is for the fans and the love of football. Right. So that's what's really bothering him here. I'm sure it hurts to not make that, but that's what at its core his concern is.
He held a 30-minute press conference that hit on a lot of different topics this week. One was the new stadium, Joe. He previously said he'd like to build that stadium with some type of roof within the next 5 to 10 years, but the pandemic has now pushed that back. Did he say for how long? And why would it push it back? Why?
It just all those talks have really paused right now. He's not engaging with different landowners about potential new stadiums. I mean, we're looking at the headquarters in Rock Hill being delayed, the start of Charlotte FC being delayed. So, you know, coronavirus has just thrown everybody through different hoops here. But as far as the stadium goes, what's interesting is now that open air stadium, given the pandemic, is looking a lot more appealing than putting everybody in the recycled air of a dome.
Well, you may not be able to have fans in the stands at Bank of America Stadium, but Bank of America Stadium and the Spectrum Center will be open for early voting. The Hornets and the Panthers have committed their facilities to be early voting sites. How will they use these facilities, and will that mean there will be fewer early voting locations because these places can accommodate more people?
Well, this is in part driven by the players in the NFL and the NBA wanting to have more of a social impact with all the things going on in the world at large. And so voting has become a major cause for them and for the teams. And also with coronavirus, it's much better to have people spaced. These are big venues. What's interesting, though, Mike, is that, in fact, the number of early voting locations has increased from 22 in 2016 to 33 this time, and with these larger venues. So all of that should help to make people feel more comfortable as they go to vote.
Early voting begins October the 15th and ends on October the 31st. The Hornets are urging people to vote. They have a swarm the polls drive to register voters. And to this morning, the elections boards around the state are sending out mail-in ballots to those people who have requested them. Yesterday, was it yesterday or the day before, President Trump was in Wilmington, where the president committed a felony by urging people to vote twice.
On your ballots, if you get the unsolicited ballots, send it in and then go make sure it counted. And if it doesn't tabulate, you vote. You just vote. And then if they tabulate it very late, which they shouldn't be doing, they'll see you voted, and so it won't count. So send it in early and then go and vote.
Urging people to vote more than once is a felony, punished by having your voting privileges revoked and by a year in prison. And the same is true if you actually try to vote twice. That's the same penalty. This came the day after the State Board of Elections unveiled a feature that allows voters to request an absentee ballot online. The president is inaccurately telling people that mail-in voting is rife with fraud. It is not. So how does he justify telling people to vote twice?
Well, I had a chance to talk to the vice president about this yesterday, and he basically said that it was the president's intention for people to verify their ballots, not actually vote twice. I read back exactly what he said to the vice president, and he stuck with that excuse.
And he said it again. He said it again in Pennsylvania.
Exactly. Exactly. The fact of the matter is the president said what he said, and what he said is illegal. If you cannot vote twice in North Carolina, it's a horrible idea. You can get
anywhere.
In a lot of trouble.
You know, you can't vote twice anywhere, but I'm not sure that the attorney general knows that, because he was on CNN with Wolf Blitzer talking about this.
If somebody mailed in a ballot and then actually showed up to vote in person, that would be illegal.
I don't know what the law in the particular state says.
You can't vote twice.
Well, I don't know what the law in the particular state says and when that vote becomes final.
Is there any state that says you can vote twice?
Well, there's some, you know, maybe that you can change your vote up to a particular time. I don't know what the law
is.
I'm not going to offer.
He was saying test
well,
the system.
You know, well, if you know what he's saying, why are you asking me what he's saying?
He doesn't believe in the mail-in voting. You're the Attorney General of the United States.
Why don't you? Yeah.
Will somebody please tell me why the Attorney General of the United States does not know you cannot vote twice anywhere in the United States of America? Glenn, you wanted to say something. I'm sorry.
No, I was saying, as Joe pointed out last night on the air, anyone who is concerned about their mail-in vote not being counted or tabulated, there is a way to do that other than to show up and cast a second ballot.
If there's been a good side to this, it's been that the officials in North Carolina have rushed to explain how things really work. For starters, you're not going to get an unsolicited mail-in ballot in North Carolina. There are some states that mail them out to everybody. Mm-hmm. You're not getting one unless you've requested it. And there is going to be a way that you can go online to check if you mail yours in. You can request a ballot and then decide you don't want to do mail-in, and then you can go to the polls and vote. That's fine. If you mail your ballot in and then decide you've changed your mind and you want to go vote again, no, do not do that. That's not okay. So they're saying, if you want to make sure that it's gotten there, there is a way to do this. It does not involve going to the polls and trying to vote twice.
Joe.
Exactly. There are lots of different ways to do this. NCSBE posts your voter information online. You can search your name. You could check to see whether your absentee ballot has been accepted. They're also launching something called Ballot Tracks, which is basically like the Domino's Pizza Delivery app tracker. So you can track the status of your absentee ballot as it makes its way to the mail and to your elections board. You also can just call the Board of Elections. options. They'll help you out over the phone. You can go in person to verify it, but it is just so unnecessary. It's going to take up time. You're going to take up a space in the line. You're going to risk yourself exposing yourself to COVID-19. There's so many other easier options for you that you should consider before doing that.
This is part of a pattern of chaos and confusion, and it's a dangerous pattern, and we should just ignore it. CMS has had some good news and some bad news this week. First, the good news, Ann, no layoffs?
Well, and Joe actually might want to take this one because I believe he covered the county meeting. All but yes, they had said that the county forcing them into a $15 an hour minimum wage might create layoffs. In fact, apparently they found another solution. Joe, do you want to go with that?
Yeah, no layoffs, which was something that county commissioners celebrated and praised, and they patted each other on the back for accomplishing this, getting people their raises. But then they found out that as a result of no layoffs, they're just not going to hire the psychologists and guidance counselors and social workers that they originally allocated the money for. And in addition to that, they had to eliminate about 175 positions that were not filled at the time. They just aren't hiring those spots. And I got to tell you, when county commissioners found out about the psychologists and the guidance counselors part, it made them very, very angry.
Well, that was my next question, because they set aside this money specifically for social workers, psychologists, and guidance counselors in the aftermath of these school shootings, because the school system kept saying these kids are troubled and they need help talking this out, et cetera, et cetera. Can the school board just take money that was earmarked for a certain purpose by the county commission and put it over here?
The county commission does not earmark except for very broad categories. And that's a perennial source of frustration, is that I think county commissioners sometimes want to micromanage and tell CMS how to do their budget. Hmm. CMS doesn't have taxing authority, but they do have responsibility for their budget. So they're saying, look, if you back us into a corner over here, we have to do something difficult. We decided not to eliminate jobs that have people in them. We're going to eliminate jobs that don't have people in them, which is a workforce of 19,000, so 175 is kind of small. And we are not going to then be able to do this other thing that is really important.
But we're also hearing, we heard the reason they gave that money, that extra money for guidance counselors and psychologists, was because kids may need that help in this environment where guns are being brought to school. And now we have kids who have been cooped up, who are experiencing trauma and tension over going to school online, and when they come back, they also may need additional help. Are we shooting ourselves in the foot here?
In so many ways, yes. The school board is definitely in a very difficult position, I will grant that. But during this time of racial and economic reckoning, this is going to impact children who are at the bottom of the ladder, those families who are trying to get a toehold. And this is unfortunate. I wish there had been some other way to span that budget gap other than kind of on the backs of these students and families, if you will.
Last week, video was released, and we played the audio from it, of the June 2nd incident in which police kettled a group of protesters on 4th Street, blocked their movement forward, their movement backward, and then fired pepper bullets and tear gas. The audio from that was from an officer telling others with relish about what was about to happen. And this week, CMPD Chief Johnny Jennings met with reporters, and he told WFAE Sarah D'Elia mistakes were made.
There were things that we don't ever want to repeat again within CMPD, although those tactics and the distribution of riot control agents were within policy at that point. We were very clear that we don't want to ever see this happen again, and we've taken measures to make sure that it doesn't.
And again, to their credit, it was the police who insisted that that video be released. Not only was the president in Wilmington, the vice president was here in North Carolina, in Raleigh, and he reiterated the claim there, Joe, that the Democrats support infanticide. That's the killing of live children. Do Democrats, any Democrats, anywhere, support the murder of live children?
No.
So how do ridiculous and easily disprovable claims like that help any candidate anywhere, anytime? Very quickly, I have 10 seconds.
He's appealing to his base. The other line that they're using now is abortion on demand. But nobody in the world supports murdering live children.
Well, I'm glad to hear it. Joe Bruno, reporter for WSSE-TV, Glenn Birkins, founder and publisher of QCityMetro.com, Eric Spanberg, managing editor of the Business Journal, and Ann Doss Helms, education reporter for WFAE News. Thank you all. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.